This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Hello and welcome to this episode of LGIM Talks. I'm Max Julius. I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, Chief Investment Officer, and Emil van den Heiligenberg, Head of Asset Allocation, to discuss what's in store for markets in 2020. Sonia and Emil, welcome back to the pod.
Hello.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, 2019 has been an extraordinary year for investors, given the returns that some asset classes have racked up. And the economic outlook will clearly be key to whether investors can aspire to anything like these sorts of gains in 2020. Sonia, what's LGIM's base case macro view for next year, and what are the key risks to this view?
I'm not quite sure whether it's fair to say that we have a base case, because it's really extraordinary what markets have delivered in 2019, considering political risks across, you know, a large number of countries. We've seen a rise in protests, and really we have not been short of negative headlines. And if we think about 2020, we unfortunately have to assume that a lot of these will continue, because we haven't seen a solution to a lot of the topics that we have discussed this year. So if you want to think about a base case, we have to think about the fundamentals. How is the economy going to look like in 2020? Secondly, central banks. What is their reaction function going to look like? And thirdly, politics. We have obviously had the election here in the UK, but we will have the US presidential election coming up. And as such, there will be a lot to talk about in 2020. And I think we, for ourselves, have said we need to stay humble. We will need to analyze incoming data for what it is, because we have to understand that trying to assess political risks is incredibly difficult. And the fundamentals, yes, they give us a clue, but probably aren't only half of the story. So when we look at fundamentals, we have said already we are end of cycle, and this is not going to change. We have seen a clear split between the manufacturing side of the economy and the consumer-led side. The consumer has stayed very strong, and we do expect the consumer to remain supported by labour markets, but the manufacturing side, and hence investment by corporates, clearly is a factor that we're watching very carefully. And that obviously leads to the political situation, because it's very clear companies like certainty, and unless we can give it to them, we might see a remain subdued environment there.
Right. Well, to hone in on one of the risks you just discussed, an obvious event risk on the horizon is the US election, as you've just mentioned. Do you both think that investors might be underestimating the ways in which this could disrupt markets?
I think it is very clear that markets are not pricing a lot of risk at the moment. If you look at the S&P 500 at historic highs and where Treasury yields are, it seems there is obviously an understanding of the late cycle nature of markets, but there's very little priced in for the potential political risks. And if you look at the spectrum of candidates that the Democratic Party is currently looking at, then you see that there's a few topics emerging that clearly have the potential to disrupt markets quite a bit.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think actually probably the U.S. election could very well, with hindsight, if we look back in end of next year, be the driver of markets in 2020. Sort of a couple of points to make. One is, for instance, if you look to the long-term history, so as an investor, I always look at what is the base rate, what's normal. If you look to a very long-term history, then usually U.S. presidential election years are positive for markets. And why is that? Because presidents realize that the economy gets them re-elected. So clearly, it's in the interest of the incumbent president to sort of make sure that the economy has positive momentum. And clearly, Trump will try to do that. However, we also think, as Sonia already alluded to, that the market is currently underestimating the fact that a quite left-wing, or at least for US tradition, a quite left-wing Democratic presidential candidate will get a chance of actually winning the White House. This will especially drive markets early in the year, because then you have the Democratic pre-elections.
Right, the primaries.
The primaries. Yep. Sorry, that was the right word I was looking for. And then last point is, let's say Trump gets re-elected. I think the market will then quickly realize that that's his second term. After that, he doesn't have a election to fight for, and he might even become more unpredictable than he already is. So that's sort of where the dynamics are in markets. And in general, I think that that risk is not really priced. Yes, investors talk about it. The media will shift quite rapidly in March when the primaries are heating up towards US election as well. And that's where the market will start to focus on this as well.
There's been a lot of talk about fiscal easing next year. Is this another area where investors could be wrong-footed?
I think we have to first and foremost look at the fiscal debate in the context of monetary policy, because what we have seen, and we should not underestimate the importance of the change in central bank policy over the course of 2019 as a main supporter for markets. Because the Fed started easing at the end of 2018 when markets turned really south and we had this very weak market period at the end of 2018, which literally kicked off a turn back towards full steam easing across most of the major central banks, which obviously with the ECB in particular already starting from negative rates has caused this debate to move forwards to say, now what's next? So if the economy really were to enter a recession, what actually are the stimulating measures the central banks could use to help avert a deepening of the route? Which then very quickly obviously led to the question, you know, what's the potency of remaining policy measures? And do we need fiscal to take over from central banks to help economies stabilizing? And this obviously has really manifested itself in the expectation that we would see a very smooth handover from central banks to governments, and hence there's no problem, which again is something that markets might not price properly, because the debate seems to not really think about debt sustainability or the idea around fiscal headroom or fiscal space that actually gives room for governments to spend some money. So lots to think about. But we have seen, obviously, in the UK election as well, fiscal did feature very highly. We have seen, again, very interesting opposing ends of the spectrum. And again, the market has not probably been confronted with the realism yet on how practically we can implement this over the next couple of years.
Right, yes. Because, of course, the fiscal boost in the UK is actually quite modest. Emil, do you have a view on the doability of fiscal easing next year?
Well, I think if you expect a lot from fiscal in the next year, then you probably are going to be disappointed. If you see this as a long-term trend, so we see this, Sonia and I see this as a trend which will play out in the next five years, or if you get a recession, then fiscal stimulus and even perhaps even coordinated fiscal policy with monetary policy, i.e. sort of helicopter money like strategies, become way more realistic. If you think about this as a key driver for markets in the next year, then I think you're going to be disappointed. Sonia and I meet a lot of policymakers, and given our backgrounds, Dutch and German policymakers are probably quite willing to talk to us. And these people are still talking about fiscal rationality, fiscal modesty. There is no right. big investment plan planned in these countries. And as we already spoke about the election, I think the fiscal boost you can expect after the elections is relatively modest, the conservatives even ridiculed the sort of massive fiscal spending from Labour. That means there is marginal change, but there's no sea change. However, I think once you get in a recession, more things get fluent and people are then prepared to think about bigger investment plans. Perhaps even, and we're going to talk about that later, I think, green ESG-driven investment plans. Right.
That's really interesting. So the countries that are most able to act in Northern Europe, say, are the least willing to do so. This sets us up really nicely to talk about last week's UK election results, where we'd be remiss if we didn't discuss it. What do you think are the key takeaways for investors, and is it likely to trigger a flood of cash back into UK equities?
I think we've been very clear that we see the UK election, obviously, as a very necessary step to address uncertainty. And this is clearly the result that we have seen. But we should not forget the hard task starts now, which is the negotiation of a free trade agreement with the EU. And this will be obviously fraught with uncertainty and problems and emotions and everything we have seen before. And I think, again, the market has been very fixated on the election outcome, and it's it's very clear, obviously, that the result is positive because it removes uncertainty of a hung parliament. So at least there is now a government in place that can take action, and there's no excuse for not taking any action because they have the majority in parliament. This is what actually the market reaction is telling you. This is why you have seen the positive reaction in small mid-cap and domestically focused stocks. This is why we have seen gilt yields coming off a bit. So all kind of taking away the uncertainty that was priced in prior to that. The main focus will be obviously on the upcoming negotiations and obviously the incoming data showing us a bit more on how companies are actually seeing that result. Because for them, intuitively, our thought is they probably still hold back because unless they know what the future relationship looks like, you wouldn't probably spend a lot of money and invest in new kind of manufacturing capabilities. I think given that we talked about fiscal just now, the question that comes up quite often is what does it mean for gilt yields? And this was particularly important in the context of having two very extreme fiscal programs. As we've just identified, the Conservatives probably have been quite conservative. It's a very modest program because it is well within the bands that they set themselves, whereas obviously Labour would have been far more explicit in a big spending program because big spending means bigger gilt supply and as such, obviously a big question mark around what this means for gilt yields. But I think for the time being, it's been a positive, but I think we probably think that the hard task is yet to come and ahead of us.
We as an asset allocation team, we very much prepared for this election. The mantra we always have is prepare, don't predict. A couple of things which we did is we prepared for an all-nighter. So means we had traders in place. We had fund managers in place to sort of manage the risk if that was necessary during the night. And second point is we did scenario analyses. So trying to think what happens in a big Labour victory, what happens in a hung parliament, and what happens in a big Conservative victory. I think sort of if you look to market prices, then almost straight after the exit poll, which sort of predicted a large Conservative victory, market prices, except one, I'll talk about that in a minute, but market prices quickly adjusted to the sort of the levels which we expected when we thought about that in the scenario before it happened. If you the one asset class which is in our is interesting are UK equities. UK equities have been avoided by global and European equity managers as basically too difficult to forecast. That means they're cheap and they're underowned. Now, if you get uncertainty taken away, suddenly UK equities come back into the perspective of a European equity manager or a global equity manager. That's not a trend which immediately adjusts itself in a day or in a few days. That will be a gradual trickling in of money. So therefore, we started going overweight UK equities a day before the election, and we've increased that after the election. As Sonia already said, the Brexit debate is not over.
It's not an event. It's a process or a journey.
Yes,
really.
It's the trade agreement and how it seems now that Boris Johnson wants to go for no extension of the trade agreement, which more or less means there's another cliff edge. And he does that obviously to create negotiating power and a sense of urgency around these trade negotiations. But for companies, it simply means there's another cliff edge in the end of the year. How are they going to react on that? Right. That's difficult to say at the moment.
Well, we can discuss that at next year's 2021 Outlook podcast. Staying with the stock market, but moving on, following a long period in which growth stocks have outperformed value, are we likely to see a style rotation in equities, perhaps next year? And if we do, how significant could its impact be?
That is a very interesting question that we've looked at in detail, simply because this is an unprecedented time period that growth has outperformed value over 10 years. Looking at the same 10 years, we obviously know this has gone hand in hand with the aggressive monetary stimulus we've seen from central banks. So a link between the two clearly is what we should be looking at. And that brings me right, obviously, to add the bond yield question to the equation, because it seems that the growth stocks have outperformed dramatically with the ever lower bond yield environment that we have seen. And it has to be thought about in the context of the discount mechanism, and the lower your discount rate, the more you are willing to pay for future earnings, because you are literally discounting future earnings more slowly. And as such, they appeared more attractive compared to value stocks. This is very interesting because the question is, if we assume that interest rates stay where they are, can we expect a proper reversal? And I think that is this is where the area is a bit hazy and it's not as clear cut. But given that the outperformance has been so dramatic, we should assume a more nuanced environment, because we assume that bond yields potentially, most likely, will stay where they are. And as such, you will no longer have the boost from ever lower bond yields that will influence the equity market. And as such, you know, we have seen already quite sharp reversals short term, where value stocks, because they're so incredibly cheap now, have massive reversal rallies. And I would think that we might see more of these, at least in 2020. And this is something that investors have not really engaged with. It was such a clear trend for such a long period of time that, you know, any reversal might actually be quite painful. And it's definitely an area, UK domestic stocks, that we look at, because there might be tradable rallies in there.
Right, well, that's definitely something to watch next year. Emil, drawing together everything we've just discussed about the outlook for 2020, what does all of this mean for asset allocation?
Well, Sonia already sort of in her introduction already mentioned a lot of the arguments I'm gonna touch upon as well. We are somewhat cautious on risk. We believe that actually now is the moment to start sort of, how we say it, leaning against the rally. We're especially cautious on credits and to a lesser extent on equities as well. Sort of 5 points I want to make. One is we are late cycle, as mentioned by Sonia. Late cycle doesn't mean equities return by definition negative, but it becomes riskier to invest in equities because volatility goes up and the drawdowns, the sudden drawdowns, the chances of that increase. The second one is US election risk. We already spoke about that. The other one is, the third one is, I think we are too optimistic about trade and trade war. Yes, we've seen a deal, but it's a very small deal. It's the half of 15% of tariffs over $150 billion.
Oh, this is the US-China ceasefire, if you like.
In a way. So it's indeed, it's much more like a ceasefire than an all-encompassing deal. Trump will try to sell it as a deal, but I think equity investors or investors are smarter than that. Trump is also, we've touched upon that as well, Trump is also very unpredictable. People might remember the trade deal we've done with Mexico. A few months after he signed the trade deal, he then came back to it because he thought Mexicans were weak on immigration. So he with one stroke of the pen, he sort of reversed the deal. The other one is the standoff between the US and China. We spoke about this in previous podcasts as well. Is something which is structural. It's not a trade deal slightly better, slightly worse, which or is it moving that big structural trend where China is competing with the US. That's something which will be with us for the coming 10, 20 years.
Right, it's a broader geopolitical point.
Yes.
Right.
And that's translated into lots of different elements, like there are talks to actually install capital controls in the US, will make it much more difficult for Chinese companies to invest in US, but also to list on US stock exchanges. There's talk about export controls on technology towards China to protect the technological know-how. There are tensions around Hong Kong. There are tensions around Chinese Muslims. There are tensions around the South China Sea. So there's plenty of points where this could heat up in 2020 quite dramatically, I would say. So that's the third point. Trade, people are overestimating the relaxation of the trade war we see. And China itself, the Chinese economy, won't grow as fast next year as it has done in the last 5 years. This won't support global growth, therefore, as much as last year. Another negative. And then the last one is the doom of consensus, I would say. In my piece of the Outlook, in a written piece, I call that fighting FOMO, fighting the fear of missing out. What you see at the moment is the Santa rally. So you see a rally in year end. Everyone wants to participate in this rally. And as I said, we want to lean against. We want to be a bit more cautious than the market in this rally. And why? Because the vast majority of investors is actually bullish. They're not mega bullish. They're not expecting a repeat of of 2019, like 20% plus equity returns, but sort of everyone is expecting 10, 15% equity return. And history learns that year-end consensus, to go against year-end consensus actually pays off. And it often pays off to be cautious when others are bullish. And that's what we try to do for our clients at the moment.
Very interesting. Well, finally, one last point I'd raise, that another area that's dominated investor attention this year has been all things to do with environmental, social and governance considerations in investment processes. How do you both see the debate around ESG developing next year?
I think it's very clear that, if anything, the debate will accelerate, will be more public, will be bigger, global, and will probably have a lot more touch points than it has ever had before. And with that, we will come back to what we have discussed previously as well, is what is the responsibility for us as a large global asset manager in our capital allocation decision. And I think very clearly, as the group in stating its inclusive capitalism vision, we have a responsibility to understand what is our responsibility. We are well known for our active ownership through our corporate governance team, and we, are, as the investment side, will then provide the active engagement piece. So really, to tie everything together, we see our responsibility in moving away from a narrower shareholder value concept to a much broader stakeholder concept, because our responsibility has to be to have a full vision on how our capital allocation will influence not only the shareholders in the company, but the stakeholders that are impacted. And I think that very neatly encapsulates what we stand for and where we believe we can take this forward. Because if we believe that the debate and the impact will accelerate, we have to understand what our responsibility is to react to it.
Yeah, I have an interesting, which I think interesting, in a way, personal example from the Netherlands, my birth country. So many people argue that sort of climate risk is such a long-term trend that it actually doesn't sort of impact day-to-day decision-making. Well, this example is actually shows that it's the opposite, and that would also be the Elgin view. It is now is the time to act. It's not sort of, so you cannot sort of put this on the sort of long-term perspective and we will act sort of when the problems really sort of hit home. The Netherlands is the fifth largest economy in the euro area, and it has a serious problem with nitrogen. And the council of the state, that's the administrative high court in the Netherlands, has determined that the Netherlands is persistently violating European rules and international treaties. And that's because we have too much nitrogen emission, if you will. Now, because of that court regulation, more than 18,000 infrastructure projects have been stopped, and building projects are stalling at the moment. This, if this continues to go on, has serious impacts on the growth and even, I would argue, on the inflation numbers in the Netherlands. To fight the high court, the Netherlands is trying to do lots of different things, like cutting the speed limits on highways, a moratorium on road building, and even restricting the number of livestock each farmer can own. Deep impact in Dutch society because of this. Now, the big question is, will the world follow the Dutch example? And there it doesn't look very good. I mean, Trump is denying climate change exists because it doesn't fit him in his economic policy. And there are actually quite meager results on the United Nations conference in Madrid last week. But it is important, and we do think, and we definitely hope, but we also do think that the people will start to vote more greener as we go forward, and combining that with the fiscal policy, perhaps not next year, but in the coming years, we would expect new green deals becoming more and more frequent in countries like the Netherlands, because they don't have any alternative. But other countries will soon realize they don't have any alternative either.
Well, thank you both, Sonia, for explaining why it's so important for us as a responsible asset manager, and Emil for illustrating it with that example. I think that's a really great point to finish on. Thank you both very much for joining us today for this fascinating discussion. Thank you to our listeners, too, for joining in. To read our 2020 CIO Outlook, which drills down into the issues we've just discussed, and which includes contributions from investment teams across LGIM, click on the link in the show notes or visit lgim.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.